Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, Silence and Word, Path of Evangelization. The Vatican releases Pope Benedict's message for the next World Day for Communications. But is it a contradiction in terms? One expert thinks not. And the Catholic Church speaks Hebrew, as the latest in a series of catechetical books in Hebrew hits bookshelves in Israel. We talk to the Jesuit priest responsible for the growing community in the Holy Land. Silence and Word, Path of Evangelization. That's the seemingly contradictory theme of the Church's 46th World Day for Communications, celebrated each year on the Sunday before Pentecost, this year on May 20th. The Pope traditionally releases his message for the occasion on January 24th, the feast day of St. Francis de Sales, the patron saint of writers. In his message, Pope Benedict refers to silence and word as two aspects of communication that need to be kept in balance if authentic dialogue and deep closeness between people are to be achieved. Linda Bordoni has more.
Silence and word, the Pope says, complement each other, giving communication value and meaning. In silence, he says, we are better able to listen to and understand ourselves. By remaining silent, we allow the other person to speak, to express him or herself. We avoid being tied simply to our own words and ideas. In this way, space is created for mutual listening, and deeper human relationships become possible. And the Pope highlights, it is often in silence that we observe the most authentic communication, taking place between people who are in love, with gestures, facial expressions and body language. In a time when messages and information are plentiful, he continues, silence becomes essential if we are to distinguish what is important from what is insignificant or secondary. And the Pope reflects on the process of communication, which nowadays is largely fueled by questions in search of answers. He mentions the role of search engines, social networks, and the internet, and points out that people today are frequently bombarded with answers to questions they have never asked and to needs of which they were unaware. If we are to recognize and focus upon the truly important questions, Benedict says, then silence is a precious commodity that enables us to exercise proper discernment in the face of the surcharge of stimuli and data that we receive. And he says that amid the complexity and diversity of the world of communications, many find themselves confronted with the ultimate questions of human existence. Who am I? What can I know? What ought I to do? What may I hope? It's important, the Pope says, to affirm those who ask those questions, and to open up the possibility of a profound dialogue by means of words and interchange, but also through the call to silent reflection, something that is often more eloquent than a hasty answer and permits seekers to reach into the depths of their being and open themselves to the path towards knowledge that God has inscribed in human hearts. Men and women, he says, cannot rest content with the superficial and unquestioning exchange of sceptical opinions and experiences of life. We are all in search of truth, and we share this profound yearning today more than ever. So, the Pope points out, attention should be paid to the various types of websites, applications and social networks, as well as making space for silence and occasions for prayer, meditation or sharing of the Word of God. And pointing out that the God of biblical revelation speaks also without words, we in turn discover in silence the possibility of speaking with God and about God. In speaking of God's grandeur, he says, our language will always prove inadequate and must make space for silent contemplation, which immerses us in the source of that love, directing us towards our neighbours so that we may feel their suffering and offer them the light of Christ his message of life and his saving gift. And speaking of the fundamental question of the meaning of human existence, the Pope says it finds in the mystery of Christ an answer capable of bringing peace to the restless human heart. The Church's mission springs from this mystery, he says, and it is this mystery which impels Christians to become heralds of hope and salvation, witnesses of that love which promotes human dignity and builds justice and peace. In conclusion, Pope Benedict said, "Learning to communicate is learning to listen and contemplate as well as speak." This, he says, is especially important for those engaged in the task of evangelization. I'm Linda Bordoni.
When they announced the theme, the Pontifical Council for Social Communications said the Holy Father clearly desired to associate it with the October Synod of Bishops, whose own theme is the new evangelization for the transmission of the Christian faith. Well, Jean-Pierre Ruiz is a biblical scholar and theology professor at St. John's University in New York and an expert in new media. I asked him how silence can be a part of communicating the faith in the digital age.
I think that to choose the theme of silence as the theme for the World Communications Day is strangely eloquent, to tell you the truth, because we live in a world where words, in a certain sense, have become a cheapened commodity, and where people say, very often, much less than they actually mean. I think that by choosing silence and word, path of evangelization, as the theme for 2012 Communications Day, the Pope has told us something about the richer qualities of communication. And in fact, the Church has been about the business of communicating not only by words for a very long time, in fact, from the beginning. I say this because the Church's liturgy, for example, is not just reading, is not just text, is not merely what we say. It's also the attitude of our bodies. It's also sound without words in terms of instrumental liturgical music. It involves the use of all of our senses in terms of the sense of smell, in terms of incense, and the flowers that are used to decorate the sanctuary for the Eucharistic liturgy and for other celebrations. So if we were to reduce communication to words, I think we would be much impoverished.
Well, how does this relate then to the new media? There you have images, you have audio, you have words. How do you see silence operating in that field?
Let me go back to St. Augustine, which might sound like a strange place to start to talk about the new media, but St. Augustine was a student of St. Ambrose. And because in antiquity, students did whatever they could to imitate their teachers, particularly when their teachers were revered, there's a story that is told of Augustine coming upon his teacher Ambrose and being quite surprised by the fact that when Ambrose was reading, he was reading silently. Well, what does this mean? It means that in antiquity, the words that were written on a page of a codex or the page of a scroll, the words were shorthand for oral communication, so that when people read in antiquity, they read to themselves and to each other out loud. Libraries in the ancient world were not places where librarians went around shushing people. The noisier the library was, the more clear an indication was that the library was being appropriately used. Private reading in silence is really only an artifact of much later history. Well, what does this imply for the new media? Well, for one thing, as the internet grew of age, it grew from being principally a text-based means of communication, where people typed things to each other across fairly limited networks, and the people who engaged in this kind of typing had to be people with a certain amount of skill and a certain amount of know-how in terms of using what were the awkward, kludgy, cumbersome technologies of that moment in what is at this point the digital past, to a situation now where by Skype I can talk to and I can see someone either here in Rome or in Indonesia in real time. So the medium has made communication more transparent. And in a certain sense, that has always been the intention of communications media, that is, to facilitate contact between people, to make it possible for people to encounter each other in meaningful ways. It's never been the role of the medium, whether print or otherwise, to stand in the way of quality communication. And the new media have done quite a lot to make communication more accessible, to make communication much more available to a broader population.
It seems to me you hit a key word there, quality. We don't always have quality on the internet, in the new media. We have people expressing opinions as facts. Facts often get distorted, so it's a question of knowing where to go to get the real facts.
There's a wonderful cartoon that appeared in the New Yorker magazine some time ago, and that cartoon depicts a dog sitting at a keyboard in front of a computer, and the caption is, "On the internet, nobody knows that you're a dog." And it's a wonderful way of capturing the way in which, to a certain extent, while the new media reveal quite a lot about the world, the new media can also conceal quite a lot about the interests of the author of a particular website, the interests or the background or the expertise of someone who is presenting information to the world. Now, we like to imagine that in the past, in the old media world, there were ways of vetting, there were ways of quality control that made it possible to identify someone who was an authorized spokesman for this or that viewpoint more effectively. Well, to a certain extent that worked, but to a certain extent that became a product of the ways in which people controlled publication in terms of the expenses, the significant expenses that are associated with publication. Because to print a book, to print a newspaper, requires an enormous infrastructure, a very intricate organization of experts in the manipulation of certain technologies, and requires selling these products to whoever happens to be willing to buy them. The internet has taken the intermediary out of that to a certain extent, which means that people can self-publish, can make information available in this way or in that way without having to invest in or without having to capture the interest of others who are willing to invest in the product that they are marketing. Now, I think net-net that has made information much more available, but at the same time it's made it that much more urgent for us to develop ways in which we can discern what constitutes quality information on the internet. So you know whether you're talking to a person or you're talking to a dog who's pretending to be a person.
We've seen some aspects of the new media in Twitter and Facebook, other media platforms such as those, being used to generate revolutions.
I think that freedom of speech is a very, very important human right and a very, very important human responsibility, because from my understanding on the basis of Catholic social teaching, I understand that rights have their correlatives in responsibilities. I also don't think it's the role of government to limit the communication by their populations, because limitation almost inevitably implies repression. And repression is the enemy of democracy, and repression is the enemy ultimately of human dignity. Now, while it can take time for things to sort themselves out, and while there are people who would use the new media for ends that violate basic human dignity, I don't think that it is appropriate for government to assume the role of monitor in that respect. What is important on the part of faith communities, on the part of the church, on the part of people who are interested in and committed to the value of human dignity, to the principle of solidarity, and to the principle of the common good, is a matter of educating people in terms of their lives as consumers of media, that is, of recipients of information, educating people to be discerning in the information that they receive from the internet and from newspapers and from television and from even such an ancient medium as radio. To train them.
I take offense at that, because there are many who would say that there is a future still for radio.
Oh, and I'm quite committed to the future of radio in that, for example, the new media have actually made it possible for radio to be heard and to be used in all sorts of new ways that were never envisioned in the days of Marconi. So it is a medium that has persisted and that has stood the test of time in terms of its adaptability to new technologies, because in the end there's nothing more powerful than the sound of a human voice. There's nothing more powerful than that. And to put a lid on that, to put a limit on the capacity for human beings to express what they really mean and to come into contact with each other by hearing the sound of each other's voices, there's nothing that replaces that. At the same time, as important as it is to educate people with respect to how they receive media, it is important to educate people with respect to their responsibility as communicators, that nothing we say is ever neutral. There's nothing that we say that doesn't need to be thought through in terms of the potential consequences, in terms of the behaviors that can be inspired by the sorts of things that we say. The sorts of things that we can say can lead us, on the one hand, to empathize with, to be in solidarity with someone halfway across the world whom we've never met, but to whom we are bound by our same human condition. And as Christians, by virtue of the fact that we recognize each other as brothers and sisters made by the same God. On the other hand, we know how words can inspire violence, how words can turn people against each other, how the violence of words can lead to bloodshed. And we need to educate people to that reality as well.
Do you think the Catholic Church is effective enough in this area of helping people to discern the negative aspects within the new media and also to educate them about how to receive it?
I think that the Pontifical Council for Social Communications and other entities within the Church globally and the Church in various local settings in many cases have taken the lead in educating people to that. I think that we have a lot yet to learn from the new media, and things move so quickly that this is a growth area for the Church and for the Church's ministries, because it does represent such important new opportunities for evangelization, for catechesis, for getting the word out about what's been called the Church's best-kept secret, which is its social teaching. The popes have made increasing use of electronic media in getting the word out. The late Pope John Paul II, for example, was as much pastor as he was media star, very conscious of the way in which his image and the sorts of things that he said in media moments made a difference in the way in which the Church was perceived and received, not just superficially, but very deeply. And Pope Benedict has followed up on this in the way in which he has encouraged the Pontifical Council for Social Communication and other entities in the Roman Curia and other offices within the Church to use the new media responsibly. The reconfiguration of the Vatican website, for example, is an exciting development, and I'm sure is an area that is under considerable growth and development and redevelopment and thinking and rethinking as it becomes more and more a cutting-edge thing. It's my understanding that the Holy See has a YouTube channel, which is, in terms of the new media, a very cutting-edge, not only technology, but outreach to generations that might have been less comfortable with old media venues for receiving words from the Church, who now have not only access to, but the availability of the real thing on the small screen.
And a warm thanks there to Father Jean-Pierre Ruiz, a biblical scholar and theology professor at St. John's University in New York. How do you teach the tenets of Catholicism to Christian children in Israel who don't know Arabic, the language most commonly heard in parishes there? With the country's growing population of Christian guest workers, refugees, and immigrants from Asia, Africa, and Eastern Europe, the native Arabic churches are finding themselves in a dilemma. How to communicate the faith in a language everyone can understand? And in a land where these migrants are fast outweighing the stagnant numbers of native Arab Christians, that language is increasingly Hebrew. The children born to Catholic Filipino parents today go to Hebrew-speaking public schools in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, where most of their friends are Jewish. They are perfectly integrated into Israeli society and are taught about the Old Testament and Jewish feasts and customs, but know very little about their own Catholic faith.
Well, in order to try to meet the growing sacramental and catechetical needs of Israel's migrant community, the Latin Patriarchate of Jerusalem set up a special vicariate for Hebrew-speaking Catholics, including those of Palestinian origin who've received Hebrew educations. Patriarchal Vicar Father David Neuhaus, the Jesuit responsible for them, estimates that more than 200,000 foreign workers are now present in Israel, plus a large population of refugees, numbering tens of thousands.
I think that there needs to be a realization that it is becoming more and more important to have, in the state of Israel, a church that speaks Hebrew, the language of Jewish-Israeli society, and thus can engage the Jewish partners in dialogue in their own language and answer the questions that are being asked, engage in the joint process of spiritual search that is being undertaken. And here we are living in very interesting times as Israeli society becomes more and more self-confident, less and less traumatized by the historic minority experience of the Jewish people, and therefore more engaged in a dialogue with Christian partners.
Father David explains that the Hebrew-speaking Catholic Church has existed for decades in the Holy Land after it was officially erected in the mid-1950s as a pious association, not long after the foundation of the Israeli state.
We have some decades of history behind us, but we are certainly a very, very young church. The sacramental community today is very, very small. We are talking about somewhere between 400 to 500 people gathered in seven different communities, five of them Hebrew-speaking and two of them Russian-speaking, so that on the level of the administration of the sacraments, we're talking about a very small presence.
But as more and more migrants and their children learn Hebrew, he expects those numbers to rise significantly and has been preparing for them. He and a small group of collaborators, including the Franciscan Custos of the Holy Land, Pier Battista Pizzaballa, produced the first series of textbooks on Catholicism for youngsters.
The work of the Hebrew-speaking church goes way beyond the sacramental communities. A second domain of very great importance for us is the fact that in the state of Israel today, due to the presence of hundreds of thousands of foreign workers, a large population of refugees for this small country, a few tens of thousands, we have today a situation in which Catholic children, who are not Israeli, but are living in Israel and are perfectly enculturated in Israeli, Jewish, Hebrew-speaking society, are being educated in very good Israeli, Hebrew-speaking Jewish schools and receiving almost no Christian education. Our little vicariate is very concerned about that and would like to contribute to the educational process of these children by offering them the possibility, at least, of receiving also an education within the church. So this is an enormous project for us. We are a very small, modest, poor on every level group of people, but we are trying to turn out textbooks. We are writing now catechetical textbooks in Hebrew. We are going into the foreign worker and refugee communities in order to organize activities with the children. And of course, all of this is done in Hebrew.
They've also set up an English and Hebrew website for the community, the St. James's Vicariate, to share information about the church, its feast days, and provide links to papal and church documents. The address is www.catholic.co.il. It also updates the community on the church's dialogue with Jews, something which Father David, as a former Israeli Jew himself, takes especially seriously.
Adonai imachem, besorat Yeshua HaMashiach al pi Markus, tchilat besorat Yeshua HaMashiach ben Elohim.
That's Father David reading the Gospel of St. Mark in Hebrew. You can listen to it or download it from the website of the St. James's Vicariate, where he also explains the Catholic Eucharistic liturgy and offers readings in Hebrew.
Speaking Hebrew itself is a totally new experience for the church, a few decades old, as we live our Catholic lives in Hebrew. And the third domain that is very important for our vicariate is giving a voice to the church in Hebrew within Israeli Jewish society that, as I mentioned before, is becoming more and more open to the dialogue with Catholics, more and more interested in the history of the church, what the church teaches, and who is Jesus Christ. An important the rediscovery of Jesus as a Jew has, of course, an impact also on our Jewish brothers and sisters.
Now, earlier you said that many Jews are indeed curious about learning more about Christianity and what it's all about. How is Christianity and particularly Catholicism taught in schools in Israel?
Here, too, there is a growing openness. And recently I went through some of the textbooks that talk about Christianity. Most of the textbooks that talk about Christianity would be textbooks that are teaching history. And what I was very pleasantly surprised to discover is that the textbooks that have all been rewritten within the last decade have a much more positive tone than the textbooks of the past, specifically with regard to the figure of Jesus and the history of the early church. I have found that in the secular textbooks, I'm not now talking about the religious school textbooks where there are still enormous problems of a certain teaching of contempt for Christians and Christianity and for the person of Jesus. I'm speaking about the textbooks that have been written for secular Israeli Jewish schools. These textbooks are increasingly respectful and interested in the early history of Christianity, and the teaching is done with a great amount of respect. We run into problems, of course, as the history of the church develops. And, of course, in this country, the Hebrew language educational system is very focused on the Jewish experience. Focused on the Jewish experience, then, of course, the center of attraction is the very difficult and often traumatic relations between the church and the Jewish people that get underway after Constantine, most particularly during the Middle Ages and the later history. There it becomes very much more problematic, as a Christian might feel very offended by the way that the church is presented in the Hebrew language textbooks that are written for Jewish school children. At the same time, of course, the church recognizes more and more by herself the problematic nature of that history. But there is still a lot of work to be done so that Jews become more and more aware that in Israel they constitute the majority, they are the dominant, powerful majority, and therefore it becomes very necessary from an educational point of view to inculcate respect for the minorities that are present within the state of Israel, including the Christian minority.
And a very warm thanks there to Patriarchal Vicar Father David Neuhaus, the Jesuit responsible for Hebrew-speaking Catholics in the Holy Land. And I'm Tracy McClure. Laudator Jesus Christus.